Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The National Broadcasting Company brings you an address by the President of the United States from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The chief executive has paused in his train journey back to the nation's capital after 2 weeks of vacationing at Warm Springs, Georgia, to address the nation by radio. More than 8,000 people have jammed into Woolen Gymnasium to hear the president speak on the third anniversary of the Carolina Political Union at this general convocation of the university. Mr. Roosevelt is also to receive an honorary degree, that of Doctor of Laws. The Carolina Political Union, host to the president, is a nonpartisan organization controlled and operated by a group of 25 university students.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in appreciation of the democratic faith and the humane hopes your American leadership gives to the people of the world in this time of crisis and bewilderment, the University of North Carolina, by the vote of the faculty and the trustees, confers upon you the degree of Doctor of Laws. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Governor Huey, President Graham, my hosts of the Carolina Political Union, my newfound alumni of the University of North Carolina. From the bottom of my heart, I am grateful to all of you today, very happy to be a part of this great university. A very old friend of mine, the late Mr. Justice Cardozo, of the Supreme Court of the United States, said this the other day: we live in a world of change. If a body of law were in existence, adequate for the civilization of today, it could not meet the demands of tomorrow. Society is inconstant. So long as it is inconstant, there can be no constancy in law. Law defines a relation, not always between fixed points, but often between points of varying position. There is change, whether we will it or not. And it is recognition of that philosophy that has made the University of North Carolina representative of liberal teaching and liberal thought. And it is my recognition of your recognition of that philosophy that brings me so willingly to Chapel Hill today. It is a far cry from the days of my first visit to the university, nearly a quarter of a century ago. And the splendid new buildings that I saw in the last 5 minutes of my drive prove it. I came here then because my old chief, that consistent North Carolina liberal Josephus Daniels, told me that I should see for myself a great institution of learning that was thinking and acting in terms of today and tomorrow and not merely in the tradition of yesterday. In those days, 1913 and 1914, the leadership of the nation was in the hands of a great president who was seeking to recover for our social system ground that had been lost under his conservative predecessor, and to restore something of the fighting liberal spirit which the nation had gained under Theodore Roosevelt. It seemed one of our great national tragedies that just when Woodrow Wilson was beginning to accomplish definite improvements in the living standards of America, the World War not only interrupted his course, but laid the foundation for 12 years of retrogression. I say this advisedly because it is not progress, but the reverse. When a nation goes through the madness of the 20s, piling up paper profits, hatching all manner of speculations, and coming inevitably to the day when the bubble bursts. It is only the unthinking liberals of this world who see nothing but tragedy in the slowing up or temporary stopping of liberal progress. It is only the unthinking conservatives who rejoice down in their hearts when a social or economic reform fails to be 100% successful. And it is only the, what shall I call them, the possessors of headline mentality that exaggerate or distort the true objectives of those in this nation, whether they be the president of the University of North Carolina or the president of the United States, who with Mr. Justice Cardozo admit the fact of change and seek to guide into right channels that change to the greater glory of God and the greater good of mankind. You undergraduates, and possibly some of you graduates, who see me for the first time, have read in your newspapers and heard on the air that I was, at the very least, an ogre. A consorter with communists. A destroyer of the rich. A breaker of our ancient traditions. Some of you may think of me, perhaps, as the original inventor of the economic royalist, of the wicked utilities, of the money changers in the temple. You may have heard for 6 years that I was about to plunge the nation into war, that you and your little brothers would be sent to the bloody fields of battle in Europe, that I was driving the nation into bankruptcy, and that I breakfasted every morning on a dish of grilled millionaire. Actually, I am an exceedingly mild-mannered person, a practitioner of peace, both domestic and foreign, a believer in the capitalistic system, and for my breakfast, a devotee of scrambled eggs. You have read that as a result of the balloting last November, the liberal forces in the United States are on their way to the cemetery. Yet I ask you to remember that liberal forces in the United States have often been killed and buried, with the inevitable result that in short order, they have come to life again with more strength than they had before. It is also true that other men in public life have protested in the past against certain forms of economic control, and that epithets far stronger than any I have ever used have been employed even by presidents of the United States. Those of us who knew Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt and Grover Cleveland could hardly call any of them mollycoddles. I was reading a letter of Theodore Roosevelt the other day, written to a friend in the spring of 1908. And it will, I think, interest and amuse you if I quote from it. He was writing to a man who was fighting in the cause of social and political decency out on the Pacific coast. And here's what he said. Now and then you must feel downhearted when you see men guilty of the most atrocious crimes who, for some cause or other, succeed in escaping punishment. And especially when you see men of wealth, of high business, and in a sense of high social standing, banded together against you. My dear sir, I want you to feel that your experience is simply the experience of all of us who are engaged in this fight. There is no form of slander and wicked falsehood in which the New York papers, not only those representing the lowest type of demagogy, but those representing the interests that call themselves preeminently conservative, preeminently cultured, have not indulged in as regards myself. From all that I can gather, the feeling against me, not only in Wall Street, not only in the business houses of the greatest financiers of New York, but also in most of the uptown clubs, it is just in these places that the feeling against me has been most bitter. As a matter of fact, I do not care a snap of my finger about it. I do not care whether they think well of me or think ill of me. But I do care a very great deal to do this work without flinching, on the one hand, and on the other without becoming angered or irritated to a degree that will in any way cause me to lose my head. Now, so it is with you and your associates. You must keep reasonably good-natured. But above all things, you must not lose heart. And you must battle on valiantly. No matter what the biggest businessmen may say, no matter what the mob may say, no matter what may be said by that element which chooses to regard itself as socially the highest element, you are in a fight for plain decency, for the plain democracy of the plain people who believe in honesty and in fair dealing between man and man. Do not get disheartened and keep up the fight. Sincerely yours, Theodore Roosevelt. He, born of an old New York family, Southern on his mother's side, trained as a young man on our western frontiers, was perhaps the first American president in modern times who knew the whole nation.